This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena, the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, Sharat, we're going to talk about Foucault's position on the Iranian Revolution, and particularly the lessons and questions that they still hold for us today, especially when we talk about, you know, questions about the relationship between the West and the Islamic world and, you know, whether there is one model of progress or social change. I think the recent interest in this connection between Foucault and Iran really harks to the broader discourse around comparative political worldviews that we cannot help but to face in a globalized world.
So, okay, first off, for, you know, the Iranian Revolution, because it happened 37 years ago, mm-hmm. you were probably around 2 or 3.
Yeah.
I was 13, 12, 13 by that time, and, you know, in secondary school. And I remember it quite clearly, partly because it was in the papers, it was on the news. Mm-hmm. I don't think I really truly understood what was going on, but to the extent that it was in the air and people were talking about it. And of course, we do know now that it influenced a whole generation mm-hmm. of Malaysian activists, especially on the kind of Islamic end of the spectrum, who saw in Iran the possibilities of a particular form of social change that carried or spoke through the idiom of religion, mm-hmm. in particular Islam.
Yeah, I think that's important to note as we preface this discussion, that it had deep and far-reaching impact locally. I mean, if you think about the idea of when we talk about the leadership, political leadership by the ulamas, it's really referencing that pioneering move that was exactly attempted in the Iranian Revolution, right? We talk about Vilayatul Faqih.
Which is that concept of leadership by the clerics, is
correct,
it?
Correct.
Now, before we get into the stuff of the Iranian Revolution, I just want to ask you, Fuad, yeah, you were 2 and 3, and I imagine you to be a precocious and maybe kind of intelligent. Maybe you could have understood what was going on. But when did you come to an awareness of the importance of the Islamic Revolution? Now, clearly, you know, the Iranian Revolution continues to inspire or, you know, or terrify, depending who you are, mm-hmm. generations after who didn't have direct experience of it, even on a kind of mediatized fashion, right, through television and such. When did you come to kind of be cognizant of the Iranian Revolution?
It was during the height of my search, my spiritual search. At that point, I was still a consistently committed Muslim. So by that, I mean, I just had a lot of guilt, you know. So, but I wanted to know about what Islam could offer. And of course, I had to look, among other things, you know, alongside the spiritual traditions, the political response to the world. And of course, you can't avoid the Iranian Revolution.
Because this happened so when you were at age 7. Come on, put a number to it. Give us a number.
This is a bit more recent than that. I was probably in my mid-20s. So you just had to read about Iran because it just changed the landscape of world politics, right? And it nicely dovetailed a broader discourse around anti-imperialism, right? So Khomeini, when he realized that the Iranian Revolution is being attacked across the region, across the Middle East, he wanted to appeal to broader anti-imperialist sentiments so that the oppressed of the world could relate to the overthrowing of the Shah. Now, this has changed a lot. I think we really have to locate the discourse today where the Wahhabi project, seeing how the Iranian experiment presents a rival political model, has since then stepped up its outreach to the world and started exporting its theology and its attitude towards scriptural literacy in contrast to the more Republican-ish experiment that the Iranian Revolution was trying. So today, I don't feel that the openness towards what Iran was trying to do is as present as it was when I was during my search days. Today, there's a lot more stigma stigma, particularly fueled by recent anti-Shia sentiments because of Bashar Assad and stuff. So you see a marked shift in common Muslim attitudes about Iran, where during my time, the room for sympathy was much greater, but now it's very negative.
Well, you know, what's also interesting was, and I'm talking about a peculiarly kind of secular outlook, right? Iran is marked by many things, and I guess different people looking at it will remember different things. Mm-hmm. I do remember the debacle over Salman Rushdie. So there you had the fatwa by Khomeini against this English writer, Indian English writer, rather Indian British writer, and you know, and his satanic verses. And that, I think, also captured a particular moment of engagement. That moment represented another clash, perhaps, or a point of engagement between the West and intellectuals aligned to a Western notion of modernity and such, and a different logic, right? The question of who people taking offense and communities taking offense, and and the power of that community in resisting or responding to that insult, and how far they would go, right? So, I mean, after what we've seen the last decade with ISIL and such, I mean, Khomeini's fatwa seems so benign in comparison.
That's
right?
A good way of looking at it.
The sheer brutality that it's come to represent a particular interpretation of the faith. And and so, again, you know, for me, the Iran, the Iranian experiment now, you know, more than a generation deep, now, you know, people who a whole generation of Iranians growing up knowing no other thing except an Iranian form of democracy, you know, which is, you know, and the translation of that very concept that you mentioned earlier.
Vilayatul Faqih.
Okay. I mean, the realization of this. And I think that comes back to, you know, we come back to a Foucault, a French scholar who at the cusp of this historic change imagined a future perhaps very different from what has in fact transpired. The question was, you know, is it simply a question of saying, well, Foucault was just wrong? He imagined something much more benign, much more open. You know, he saw the possibilities of women being treated with respect. He saw the possibilities of minorities not being oppressed. You know, he even perhaps imagined that the kind of a proto-fascist state or the fascist state that the Shah, you know, operated would disappear in some sense, right? So the evil Savak, the secret police of the Iranians, of the Iranian state under the Shah, would then disappear. Of course, a very different story has unfolded in Iran, hasn't it?
But more than that, we should not underplay the fact that it was an anti-imperialist mass movement. I think that was what really hooked Foucault before the more, you know, theological or religious questions.
Yeah, and
emerged.
You know, and in fact, we forget that the social forces aligned against the Shah were so much more diverse. You had the Marxist and the communist movement, and a whole range of, you know, liberal bourgeois forces, you know, who aligned themselves against the Shah at that point. The dominance of the Shah, you know, came later, right? And the overturning of the revolution, or the turning of the revolution to make it specifically Islamic, really happens after the takeover by these so-called democratic forces.
Correct. And what happened after that, and this is often left out in discussions about Iran, was that it was under attack. And it, since then, it has been under attack. You know, the Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, supported by the West.
Supported by the West, basically, yeah. So,
and that terrible long Iran-Iraq war, right, that damaged so many people. Yeah, in fact, you know, if you, there's a Polish journalist who wrote about his experiences in Iran, I think a year into the Iranian Revolution, Richard Kapuscinski writes about it. I mean, I think they have a very... The question was, what was this revolution going to be like? You know, and we now, of course, have writings about it, and perhaps we could look specifically at the kind of claims Foucault was making for the revolution at its inception.
Well, he was sent first of all as journalist, but you know, I think we should finesse this a bit more. By that time, he had already established himself as a notable philosopher. In fact, if you look at the history of French philosophy, he had pretty much displaced Sartre as the public figure of philosophy at that time. So one of the reasons why he was picked to go to Iran to report on this was because he was an opinion leader for French and in many ways European intellectual discourse. Early on, we start noticing, you know, his acknowledgement of the anti-imperial character of the movement. But what he veered towards was the alternative model of political organization that was being attempted. So he talked about alternative subjectivities. He talked about the differences and similarities between Shi'ism and what had transpired in the West. So what we have in his writings, and they were compiled recently, is a dual register. On one hand, trying to acknowledge the political force of the Iranian Revolution, but at the same time, the philosophical questions in it. And he eventually was to affirm the possibility of a different model of revolt than what he had known in his context, which is the West, which is, you know, when you think about the French Revolution, the bourgeois revolutions, and its presuppositions.
You know, Fuad, when you first suggested we talk about this, I thought to myself, well, it's been 30 years since I read a Foucault on this. And so I kind of Googled something online and I found an essay, a kind of executive summary of the book that you're holding at this point in time. And it's titled Revisiting Foucault and the Iranian Revolution by Janet Afri.
Janet Afri and Kevin Anderson.
And it's also subtitled The Seductions of Islamism. It points out several things. So I'm just basically, having just read it, mm-hmm. you know, and so I don't have a 30-year gap between when I last read the text on this. They note that he wanted to characterize the difference between revolutions that had happened in the past by using the word spiritual. So he talks about a spiritual politics. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, looking in the specific case of Iran, a unique character. And I think he surfaces this idea that the hopes of the people that were mobilized along, you know, mobilized by these organizations really was spiritual in nature. They were reaching to something different from, you know, I guess, class politics or class yep. envy or whatever it is it might be, right?
Yeah. But I do want to locate what he means by spiritual here within his broader framework. Foucault, as we know, is a secular thinker. He was never drawn to religious politics or even religion in the Judeo-Christian tradition. But what he saw as unique in Iranian political spirituality was that it came out of a different regime of truth. And this is one of his statements on that with regards to Iran. And I quote, "They don't have the same regime of truth as ours, which, it has to be said, is very special, even if it has become almost universal. The Greeks had their own. The Arabs of the Maghreb have another. And in Iran, it is largely modeled on a religion that has an exoteric form and an esoteric content. That's to say, everything that is said under the explicit form of the law also refers to another meaning. So not only is saying one thing that means another not a condemnable ambiguity, it is, on the contrary, a necessary and highly prized additional level of meaning. It's often the case that people say something that at a factual level isn't true, but which refers to another deeper meaning, which cannot be assimilated in terms of precision and observation." So what he's trying to show here is that there is a different way of talking that he does not just want to assume or transpose from his perspective. So
there is a reference to the French Marxist historian Maxime Rodesson, you know, who sort of says that at the end of the day, there is a truth that, and he calls it a law of history. He says good moral intentions, whether or not endorsed by the deity, are a weak basis for determining the practical policies of states. And it goes to this idea that, you know, in shaping a new state, that these frameworks, I think Foucault was very excited by these new cultural configurations where, mm-hmm. you know, these demands were kind of percolating through mm-hmm. and they would produce something else. But that was unlikely to be the case. And I think, you know, Foucault was seeing in people's hopes something that perhaps was not going to be translatable into a new state. Well, what seemed to happen, of course, is, you know, the old conundrums of bureaucratization, yep. paranoia turning into, you know, creating a police state and all those things that, yep. in yep. fact, happen, right?
But I do wonder sometimes if Efrain Anderson overlooked the moments when Foucault was a bit cognizant of the complexities and uncertainties of the process. So this is one bit that I want to share where Foucault says just that. And before we end for the second part, what has given the Iranian movement its intensity has been a double register. On one hand, a collective will that has been very strongly expressed politically, and on the other hand, the desire for a radical change in ordinary life. Institutions that carry a charge of chauvinism, nationalism, exclusiveness, which have a very powerful attraction for individuals. To confront so fearsome an armed power, one mustn't feel alone, nor begin with nothing. Apart from the problem of the immediate succession to the Shah, there's another question that interests me at least as much. Will this unitary movement, which for a year now has stirred up a people faced with machine guns, have the strength to cross its own frontiers and go beyond the things on which for a time it has based itself? Are those limits, are those supports going to disappear once the initial enthusiasm wanes? Or are they, on the contrary, going to take root and become stronger? Many here, and some in Iran, are waiting for and hoping for the moment when secularization will at last come back to the fore and reveal the good old type of revolution we have always known. I wonder how far they will be taken along this strange, unique road in which they seek, against the stubbornness of their destiny, against everything they have been for centuries, something quite different. So plenty to pick out there, which we'll do for the second part of the show. But for now, I think we've laid out the context and the general issues in quite some clarity, but we'll be right back. This is Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharak Kutin as usual, and you're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School, and this week we are revisiting Michel Foucault's vociferous support for the Iranian Revolution. And in the first half of the show, we went through some of the general issues and concerns that he touched on, and the questions therein. What do you make of things so far, Sharad?
Well, you know, I think of any of us who switch on the television today or watch YouTube and we see mass movements in countries, especially in countries where there is oppression. And, you know, the excitement and maybe the goosebumps we feel in empathy for those people who are able to change the course of history, as it were, of their maybe it's something limited, but still their nation, right? Mm-hmm, and it's a tremendous spectacle. And we see it over and over again. The media gives it, color codes these revolutions. You know, we have I don't know, kinds of colors that have come out so far in the last decade or so. And I think if Michel Foucault was seduced by something, he perhaps, like all of us, susceptible to the seduction of seeing people take power, right? Mm-hmm. Take charge of their lives. Mm-hmm. The idea that we are not merely objects or, you know, in history, but we are, you know, the thinking, moving subjects of history. We have agency and such. And I can see why anybody would be excited, you know, in 1979 to think that the Iranian people could overthrow, you know, a three-decade-long dictatorship, a brutal dictatorship backed by the West. But then the problems begin. And, you know, and I think the question, of course, for us is how do intellectuals, especially philosophers and social theorists, think with clarity about something like a social movement, you know, understanding perhaps its darker side, its problems, but also its emancipatory potential. I think in this story, we are looking at why Foucault focused on the emancipatory potential of the Iranian Revolution, perhaps to the exclusion of fully developing that other side of the analysis, which was the problems that would perhaps emerge.
Yeah. First thing we have to know is that at this point, by the 70s, Foucault had been at odds with the Marxist project in general. So we have to note that at this point, there was already demystification over the Soviet experiment. The European post-war welfare state had already taken root, had become bureaucratized. Social democrats pretty much in power at that point, and at least in Western Europe.
So we had the Cultural Revolution in China as a problem. We even had the Cambodian debacle, right?
Correct. But I think first things first, and we want to look at where Foucault was coming from. He realized at that point that the Marxist project had to be rethought. And pretty much the book that launched his career, The Order of Things, was questioning some of the Enlightenment outlook regarding the human sciences, upon which the not just the Marxist project, but also the liberal project, and even psychoanalysis was pretty much constructed. So for him, there was a deep flaw in some of the presuppositions of already existing emancipatory discourse, that they had taken the human subject for granted. They didn't realize that the human subject was a recent, according to Foucault at least, 19th century construction. And that this outlook about the human being being a very recent theoretical fascination cannot be universalized. So what he saw outside his usual context and in Iran was a different attitude towards emancipation, and one that, according to him, and he's going to be leveled with charges of exotification at this point, that the Shia theology that was very much animating revolutionary discourse was not as stained or tainted by the Enlightenment's conception of the individual. This was what allowed him to suspend a lot of the other criticisms that Marxists were leveling against him with regards to Iran. Like you said, the gender issue, the question of the working class, right? The question of good old-fashioned Enlightenment principles. Foucault thought that, well, we have a different way of doing revolt now. And maybe this is what we have to think about.
I take heart when he, you know, says, and I think this is a true mark of an intellectual, right? You got to put aside your prejudices. Mm-hmm. And one of the is a deep kind of knee-jerk response to certain things, right? And so he says, in response to a kind of polemic that was going on in a journal, he says, the first condition for approaching Islam with a minimum of intelligence is not to begin by bringing in hatred. Mm-hmm. And I repeat the word hatred. And I think what he saw perhaps in a traditional Marxist response was, in fact, not a hatred of Islam as such, but a hatred of religion, right? Mm-hmm. This feeling that religion is a throwback, is a residue of a non-rational, pre-modern past, mm-hmm. that somehow needs to be put aside in favor of science and the supreme science, you know, historical science of historical materialism and all that. You know, so you get this. I mean, there's a deep antipathy towards a religious mode of thinking, right, among secular leftists and Marxists in the European framework. So, and I think that was important. Maybe because of that, he was able to see something that wasn't there. Mm-hmm. But to what extent did this vision, this opening up of possibilities, also blindside him to some of the other processes that were kind of unfolding, mm-hmm. that in some ways then put him on the wrong side of history, at least in his assessment of the Iranian Revolution?
Yeah. In philosophical terms, the question at the heart of this problem is there a universal history? Right. So for Marxists, because of, like you said, historical materialism, the answer is yes, there is. And we understand this universal history through looking at capitalism. Capitalism will enter Timbuktu and you'll still see the same problems. You know, there'll be a working class, there'll be a bourgeoisie, there'll be profit motives. Society will be configured as a result. And we can see from there, you know, where the problems are going to happen, right? In the family setting, new arrangements and society challenging old view. I mean, that's the kind of, like you say, historical materialist picture. Foucault rejects that by this point. He thought he could look at it differently. So here at this point, you know, one of the things we can look at is the Marxist standpoint would say, look, it doesn't matter even if you're in the deepest jungles of the Amazon. If you see capitalism having taken root, or if it's somehow in the network of the global expansion of capital, we can start leveling judgments from that point.
Okay, so even if you're not a Marxist, right, if you come, you take a kind of humanistic approach, right, and I think Foucault already anticipated some of the problems, and he, I don't know if he dismisses them, but he says somehow the human rights framework is also inadequate, right? Mm-hmm, and so perhaps in my own assessment, I just sort of said, well, I kind of agreed with the anti-Iranian assessment, which is to say that the Iranian revolution failed, at least it failed in a particular way, and that would be the yardstick of human rights, mm-hmm, right? So we see, you know, what's happened to women, what's happened to minorities, minorities like the Kurds and the Baha'i, when you look at, you know, the persecution and the murder of homosexuals, where you see the retention of secret police and the brutalities, you know, all of those. Well, some of you say, well, you know, that's your measure. If the measure is something else, like God's plan, then what happens to your assessment? Your assessment is just one of many assessments and perhaps not the most important assessment.
But this is where the critics of Foucault have a solid point. They say that he downplays the left's contribution towards mobilizing the movement against the Shah. Instead, and of course, interestingly, Foucault, given his, you know, he's a very open person for many ways epistemically, he went to Qom. So he had spoken to Khomeini himself in Paris, and he had gone to Qom to see the seminary context, right? So there was a certain degree of selectiveness in Foucault's approach that blindsided him from the fact that there were grassroots active trade union, old-fashioned Marxist, you know, mobilization going on, you know.
But in an old-fashioned Marxist political sense, what Khomeini was able to do was to maybe beat the Marxists at their own game, beat the communists at their own game. He established hegemony over the system. You know, he what was the separation between the kind of spiritual leadership of the nation centered in Qom and the you know the temporal leadership in Tehran now got fused, right? And the idea was you bring it together, and he was able to re-engineer the state, right? So people sometimes remember Iranian democracy, you know, the elections that they have, but we forget there's this layer of guardianship, which really makes a system responsive not to the bottom, not to the populace, but really to some divine plan interpreted by this coterie of clerics who are unelected, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and the Tudeh Party, which is the left party, they miscalculated severely because after, well, what they would call a counter-revolution by the clerics, and that prompted Saddam's invasion, the Tudeh Party actually went towards Saddam's side because they thought it was a republican movement that can overthrow the clerics. And when Iranian nationalism went on defensive mode against Saddam, then Tudeh Party was caught in a bind.
Yeah, what is also interesting, and perhaps one way to find a point. I mean, if you say, well, you know, at the end of the day, does it mean we can't make any judgment of the Iranian revolution? Is there no point for which we can? We perhaps might point to some of the contradictions within contemporary Iranian society that have produced social conflicts. I mean, social conflicts that have been put down quite brutally and, you know, perhaps on par now with the brutalities of the Shah's regime. But it nevertheless, you know, when a system starts to produce its own contradictions, then you could perhaps say this is not perhaps God's plan on earth. I don't know, you know, but that's what I'm thinking.
No, I think so too. Although the problem is always extra complicated when it comes to a place so central to the imperialist crosshairs, right? Because liberalism anywhere has connections with the centers of, you know, global capital, right? That's where they get funding. I mean, here, the debates around foreign funding is mild compared to debates on foreign funding in places like, you know, Iran or Syria, right? Because there's so much at stake, right? Not just for the regimes that are there, but also for the potential that the regimes might be dismantled, right? And since then, too, like you said, we've seen so many short-lived revolutionary enthusiasms, right? All across the former Soviet bloc, right? There were always these spurts of hope, and then you see that, you know, they just fall under the neoliberal fold. So in this sense, if we want to locate Foucault in his intellectual currents, I think one of the lessons is that he really forgot the revolutionary tradition of Enlightenment France that he came out of. I think he took that for granted.
Yeah, and also I think in this critique that we're reading from, the idea that his critique of modernity and the Enlightenment project was one-sided, and he was, you know, far too willing to kind of, he was too interested, as it were, to find an alternative to it than to give credit to it, right? So in some ways, his dismissal of the problem of women, right, that he refused to see that power would be distributed in such a way that they would never, I mean, you know, the kind of privileges that men were going to assume in this new world. So the early part of the revolution, you had attacks on women who were unveiled. I mean, so there was, and he knew it, he saw it, right? But he was trying to somehow say, well, that was not the mainstream. And he kept making those kinds of arguments for the revolution, trying to somehow recoup its possibilities, emancipate it. And then maybe this hope that it would be able to rise against these much more narrow and sectarian, you know, impulses that it had that were much that were deep rooted culturally.
Eventually, though, he had to concede, right? So I think in one of the later pieces that he wrote on this, he actually said, you know, we want universal human rights. I mean, for a postmodernist to say universal human rights, I think that that was quite a leap for him, you know, because I think he wanted to play the problematizer in the beginning. He wanted to play the kind of, you know, critique of totalizing claims. But eventually, as the revolution unraveled, I think it was a good year and a half period that these pieces were released, right? He could see the limits of his approach. I think one of the things that it goes back down to, especially if we're writing from the global south, the post-colonial, post-Cold War global south, is that we still have yet to really come to terms with liberalism, right? Is it a, do we have a stagist look of it that, you know, is a necessary stage before higher forms of emancipation? Or is it really it, right? Is liberalism just as far as we can go?
I mean, one thing that Iran seems to demonstrate is the possibility of revolution, the overturning of social order, without necessarily delivering on freedom. So the freedom for individuals was certainly not a, you know, a central agenda of the Iranian revolution, at least from the little that I've read and the little that has been demonstrated over the last three decades in precisely on the question of human rights. So human rights is, in some sense, a barometer of the protections afforded to the individual, right?
Yeah, but by that time, too, we got to note that human rights wasn't as mainstream as it is today. You know, it was, for classical Marxist circles, it was still bourgeois.
But you see, but the and the socialist revolutions also suffer from the same problem, right?
Yep.
They're always to say, well, the you know the ends justify the means, and you know if you know socialist utopia was around the corner, then you could do pretty much what you wanted, including you know rescinding massacres, rescinding the rule of law, and all those things that you see replicated, right? So and also the way in which bureaucracies develop and, you know, certain privileges become part of a society. And to what extent, you know, and I think this Iranian issue, in like all contexts, the question of culture. I mean, how much can culture be overcome, at least in the short term? I mean, 30 years is not much in terms of human history. But, you know, how much can it be overcome, this whatever the enthusiasm individuals might have?
I agree. What we should do is look back to the moment of the 10 months of the revolutionary terror in France, because I think a lot of the debates that we're having today had their precursor there, you know, because once a revolution happens, you have two problems. And especially if it's a grassroots revolution, you can tell the extent to which it's grassroots by these two indicators. One, a strong countercurrent for a counter-revolution, and two, the neighbors of which maintain an ancien regime will invade the revolutionized countries, you know. And that was a lot of Robespierre's justification for the terror, you know. But
and that's how some apologists for Stalin also explain things, right? Because Russia was under attack and, you know. And so, again, we come back to this thing. I mean, at the end of the day, is social change through, you know, peaceful means possible?
Yeah.
And how would you see it? We've seen, you know, things in Latin America, some extraordinary developments there, but also, you know, reversals. And maybe that's really the nature of human society. You know, it's not a simple march forward. It's always, you know, much more like a cha-cha-cha. You know, like, I don't know.
I like my march forward. But
march forward. You do. I know.
But well, I do feel that the arguments for the suspension of, you know, certain individual liberties can still be weighed without them being abused in a Stalinist fashion, though. So,
that's a slippery slope.
So we'll look at that. We need another episode for this. But
we certainly do.
In any case, you have that article you PDF'd from Google, right?
I did indeed. Yeah. So it's Janet Afary, A-F-A-R-Y, and Kevin B. Anderson, Revisiting Foucault and the Iranian Revolution. Probably worth reading the original by Foucault,
yeah,
if you can get a hold of it.
And you can through the same author's complete work, which I think that piece draws from. It's called Foucault and the Iranian Revolution, Gender and the Seductions of Islamism. It's also by Afary and Anderson. And it has the collection of Foucault's entire writings on Iran as its appendix. And it's also chronologically ordered, and some of Foucault's critics are also included, like Maxime Rodinson and a few other Iranian emigres at that point. So if you're curious to look into this, you know the names to look up. In any case, you can tweet Sharat at Sharat Kutin, email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com, look us up on Facebook. That's BFM Night School. Just type that on the search space. Thank you for listening and tune in next week. This is Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharat Kutin. You're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.